Hello, listeners. My name is Raj Singhal, and welcome to another episode of Breaking Investment Stereotypes. This episode is brought to you by Multiply.co, where we believe that investing is an ignored life skill. Our mission is to create a platform where people can come, learn, share, and collaborate through the right tools. Ultimately, we want your hard-earned money to work for you. Here at Breaking Investment Stereotypes, my job is to deconstruct world-class investors or wealth managers. We deep dive into their investing journey and habits and how they've broken the stereotypes in a seemingly complex world of investing. For those who don't have any context on me, I was last working as MD and CEO for Bank of America for Southeast Asia, where I worked for a couple of decades. I've been a macro trader all my life and manage my own investments all the while. Investment really excites me, but I have to learn the hard way. And I clearly think that that shouldn't be the case. So what we want to do is help you untangle the world of investing. We want you to develop skills so that you can manage your investments well. I want to give a little guidance on how to use the shows. We are not giving financial advice. We're not giving stock tips. I don't think people listen to stock tips, and I sincerely believe that people are better stock pickers only in hindsight. We are here to give you principles to be used for investing. So please treat everything we discuss here as public opinion. Without further ado, I would like to introduce you through interview our guest for today, a friend for the last 15 years and an ex-colleague, Vaibhav Sanghvi. Vaibhav is currently co-CEO, Avendus Capital Public Market Alternate Strategies LLP, based out of Mumbai. Vaibhav has an overall work experience of 18 years with deep domain expertise in hedge funds. He joined Avendus in 2016. As part of his role, he is the lead portfolio manager for all his funds, and they manage close to about $1 billion and hold a track record for outperforming market across cycles. His expertise in generating risk-adjusted returns in equities across strategies has played a key role in Avendus being able to secure his position as the largest onshore hedge fund in India. Vaibhav has made a significant contribution to the development of alternate investment funds in India, being an advisor to and member of various industries bodies. Prior to joining Avendus, Vaibhav worked with Ambit Investment Managers as managing director. And during his 8-year stint with the firm, he successfully managed the largest onshore Indian hedge fund with an exemplary track record. Before Ambit, he worked for 3 years with DSP Merrill, where actually we worked together on the same desk. He started his career in 2000 with HDFC Bank, where he was part of the equities in the private banking team. Vaibhav is a chartered accountant and has graduated from Narasimha Unji College of Commerce and Economics. So without further ado, please enjoy Vaibhav Sanghvi. Vaibhav, welcome to the show. As I just mentioned, we are here to deconstruct philosophies of the investment managers, and no better than you, since you manage one of the largest hedge fund in India. So actually, before moving ahead, maybe for our listeners, you want to explain what does a hedge fund mean specifically in the context of India?
Sure. And thank you, first of all, Raj, and very glad to be here on the show. So in terms of hedge funds, right, and, you know, hedge fund is a pretty open term. From a global parlance, hedge funds connote different things. Whereas in India, hedge fund is a term which is coined in the recent past when SEBI came out with these alternate investment fund guidelines in 2012. That was the first time when SEBI actually provided a platform wherein you could have innovated on strategies, you could have used global expertise and global domain knowledge to bring something into India for the benefit of investors. You know, as you know, Raj, we in 2005, when we were in DSP Merrill Lynch, you know, initiated this whole long short fund while managing the proprietary book investments for DSP Merrill Lynch. We use that domain knowledge, we use that experience when actually SEBI introduced those alternate investment fund guidelines to use that and formally launch a hedge fund, one of the first in India in 2013. Typically, a hedge fund for a normal investor would mean that a fund which has an ability to hedge, right, which can go both long and short and does have huge amount of flexibility for doing its own investments. That is just a very basic terminology for a hedge fund. But as I said, it's an expansive statement. There can be a lot of things which can be done under an ambit of hedge funds, right, from a risk fund to a very low risk fund as well. So one has to take with a pinch of salt when somebody calls itself a hedge fund.
For a layman and for people who are starting early in their investing cycle, Do you want to simplify this whole volatility for them? I mean, you know, in simple terms, how should they look at volatility when they're looking at the investments?
I would extend that argument saying that it is not only volatility, but also in layman terms, a drawdown of a particular fund as well. Yeah. And what do I mean by drawdown is basically the negative returns in a particular month, a particular period, which you kind of define. Because an investor, you know, for an example, if somebody would have invested into Nifty only, right, from 2000 to 2020, they would got a, you know, reasonable return of about 11-12%. That which is not by no means less return, though it's an average return, but not kind of less return. However, tell me how many people would be there who would be with the investment for this long, right? People would have come into peaks and got out in the trough. And a typical example is now, since March of this year, when COVID kind of happened, you have seen consistent redemptions into mutual funds, right? Why? Purely because people are scared. People take out money when it is panic. Actually, it is the time to invest. Right. So while on theory, it looks great to invest in panics, but one has to marry that with your behavioral aspects as well. Right. So one has to be very, very clear that how somebody is comfortable in seeing those kind of negative returns in a particular month or a particular period. And that is what we call as drawdown. Right. So if a strategy has a lesser drawdown, but a lesser consistent return, and if that is something which kind of suits them, then one should go for that. But if some investor is very comfortable with the drawdown and has and looks for a higher return, then definitely he should go for that as well, right? So it all depends on one, in terms of the risk factor, the ability to see drawdowns, and as you rightly mentioned, volatility as well. Volatility is basically nothing but the standard deviation of your return. How volatile are you in generating your daily returns is what is the measure of volatility on your funds, right? Higher the volatility, higher would be the risk. Lower the volatility, lower would be the risk. And as I mentioned earlier, that typically a debt fund, a duration product, would be about 4 to 5% of your volatility. Your equity fund would be 14-15% long-term volatility. And thus, a liquid fund would be probably at about 1 to 2% of your volatility. So that is how kind of it gets structured in terms of volatility and drawdown. And those are the two aspects one has to look for.
That's a full spectrum of volatility. Liquid fund is where people can draw liquidity every single day. And, you know, those are typically doesn't deviate much. Fixed income, again, depending on the duration of the product, I mean, liquidity has a very low duration and the fixed income could have a higher duration as well. But again, the volatility of that product is lower, as you rightly mentioned. And equity, of course, comes to the other extreme, which is a lot more volatile. And people really have to make a choice between them. So you brought in an interesting topic around the behavioral science, about the human being. And while, and we have seen in our career, right? I mean, this whole greed and fear is what dominate most of the time in investing. I just want to quote, the famous investor, Warren Buffett partner, Charlie Munger. It says that it's remarkable how much long-term advantage people like us have gotten by trying to be consistently not stupid, instead of trying to be very intelligent. And, you mentioned about COVID, and I know, and I'm sure you also know that, and of course, the data also shows that the people have actually withdrawn money from the investments. For time like that, and now again, bringing in the context of the hedge fund, which you manage, what was the behavior of the hedge fund during such volatile times?
What happens is basically, so for example, I'll give you my example of how our fund actually navigated something like a period of March, right? When the index was down about 25%, my fund was down less than 1%.
Wow.
Okay. And the reason why is basically that we use long short equity, right? Meaning whenever we take exposure into markets, we take or we buy stocks and securities, which we like from a longer term fundamental point of view. At the same time, we try and short those securities which we do not like from a fundamental point of view as well. So what happens in this is basically when you are having your long position and the short position simultaneously, to a great extent, it mitigates the market risk aspect of investing. You know, everybody knows that while investing in equities, there are two types of risks. One is your market risk and one is your stock risk. By having constant hedges and by going short, you know, simultaneously when you are investing into long term, you are to a great extent mitigating that kind of risk. And that's why one of the main reasons why my volatility of the fund is very, very less. In typical that kind of March period, we were kind of less than 1% you know, of drawdown. However, at the same time, let me also tell you that when the market goes sharply up as well, we would not be able to participate equally, purely because we are long and short simultaneously. So we are more a fund like which will generate consistent returns over a period of time, irrespective of your market conditions. And it actually only fits to those kind of investors who want consistency and are scared about the drawdown, the volatility of their own investments as well. It is here, safety first, and then consistent returns. And that is what the philosophy of our absolute return fund is. And that is how we navigated that tough period.
So let me rewind a little bit. And you know, you've been investing for the last 18, 20 years now and worked in some great organizations. And now you're, you know, managing such a large hedge fund here. What's been your investing principles or, you know, investing experience you want to break down in simple terms? How do you look at investments?
Two things, and both to an extent go hand in hand, is one is basically always look at your risk appetite and look at risk factors first before investing. The moment you are comfortable with the risk, the returns will automatically come. It's just a byproduct. If you have a control on your risk, markets will give you a huge amount of opportunity every given point in time. It is just that you should be there to grab those kind of opportunities. That's one. And two, the flexibility in investment approach. You know, you would listen to lot many investment gurus who will say, you know, buy for extremely long period of time, invest at every fall. It's very easy to say. And as I rightly mentioned earlier as well, people don't understand. I mean, there would definitely be people who have done that and have been very successful. But those guys have that kind of risk appetite to see those kind of drawdowns. However, for a larger investor set, we have to be very practical and understand that whether are we capable of seeing those kind of drawdowns, that kind of volatility. If not, then one has to be very flexible in terms of your also investment approach, where you can't be keeping on buying or regular intervals of, you know, at every decline you keep on buying, there is panic, you would not be able to do it. Though you may want to it, you will not be able to do it. And that's what my experience of last 20 years teaches me. We often as human beings get too emotional about our investments and make the wrong decisions at the wrong time, right? So you have to be very flexible in terms of your investment approach to see what works when, right? Sometimes it's value time, sometimes it's growth time. And if you are a trader, then you can use those opportunities. But if you're an investor, forget about using those kind of investment because you will not be able to do because markets are very fast moving. One has to accept that. You understand your constraints. One has to understand one's own constraints and then apply the investment philosophy which suits you rather than, you know, listen to everybody, but make your own philosophy.
We all have seen in our life that there is an investment philosophy which, as you rightly said, which suits a particular person. And, you know, for two people, it can be very different, even best of the friends, or, you know, it can be very different investment journeys. Ultimately, what you are concerned is that you're compounding your money over a long period of time. Now, whether you are able to generate 10 or 12 or 14 or somebody's doing about 17, 18 or 8, clearly it all depends on how much can you tolerate. Because the markets are markets, markets are always supreme. They will always make you feel humble, you know. And we've seen that some of the people who actually outperform, they tend to diverge from crowd, not necessarily contrarian, because I generally don't like contrarian trading. But, you know, there is always an element of whether you can think little from a distance about how the markets are behaving, and based on that, ultimately. But if you just keep following crowd, I mean, you know, you're going to really underperform the market for sure. There's no doubt, because you're going to chase returns, right? I mean, you know, chasing returns never really helps. You brought in an important topic of the whole debate around value and growth. Since you've been involved in investing world, what is your thought around this whole debate?
You know, I think we are in a good situation where the debate actually is there about value and growth, because There's too much of money which is chasing investments, which is kind of opening up this debate about, you know, whether you should be looking at value. If a foreign investor is coming into India, he's actually coming for growth. And in that parlance, if he's coming for growth and trying to choose for investments into value, it's a very interesting time. You know, this is going to help to broad-base the rally into the market. At the end of it, investors always will go for growth. Value will definitely perform in a shorter span of time. Also, I'm a firm believer that value remains value unless there is an opportunity to unlock value. There has to be a catalyst which can unlock the value, you know, and can deliver returns. If it doesn't, then value would remain value for an elongated period of time. People generally lose patience while holding, you know, that kind of value. So India being a growth economy, my preference always would be for growth. But in spurts, you will see those kind of money kind of chasing value just because that growth is kind of already rallied. It has become expensive. I need some other pockets of investments which can drive the further next leg of rally. Thereby, actually, it will extend the performance in the broad-based market. And that is how I would probably see this as a good problem.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So, you know, as they say, right, cheap always gets cheaper. So cheap doesn't mean that it's a good investment. It's just that it's just cheap. That, you know, there are people who are not interested in the product doesn't mean that people, I mean, sometimes it does work. I mean, sometimes you may find a less expensive product. So as Warren Buffett said, right, price is what you pay and value is what you get. If you have to buy a good product, you sometimes have to pay a higher price because, you know, stock may actually compound much better than what the market may be pricing in right now. There's always a recency bias to things, right? I mean, you know, people tend to look at things only, you know, based on their recent experience. They're not able to visualize how things, and some of the tech stocks have really shown us globally, specifically, you know, how, say, Google, Amazon, or Facebook, they've really created value and they're actually creating cash flows now. And when they started, probably not be making money at all. You know, our podcast is all about breaking investment stereotypes. So maybe, do you want to reflect on, in your, based on your career, one or two stereotypes which you think is still very prevalent in the mentality of the people and, you know, need to be broken a lot?
Yeah, a couple of things, right? One, again, it comes to the an association with that value growth question as well. Is people think that expensive stocks, you know, there are expensive stocks and the valuations are pretty high. You know, one should not kind of venture into those names purely because you never know that it goes back to crashing in terms of the valuation premiums, which they are enjoying. But one has to understand that the valuation is there for a reason. You know, it's there for the management quality, it's there for the risk mitigation. From a business perspective, the diversification of products, the kind of the position they enjoy. So there are various many reasons for a stock to trade rich or expensive. Again, that doesn't mean that doesn't have a future potential to grow. Maybe there are stocks which we have seen trading at 45 to 50 times, you know, over the last 1.5 decades, right? They have always stayed there. And in fact, simultaneously, they have given some consistent EPS kind of growth and earnings growth. So people have made some good size money, even investing into those kind of expensive, so-called expensive stocks. So one has to, you know, be aware of the background factors of investing probably in expensive names, right? That's one. And two, time and again, I have seen that people in euphoric markets, tend to come in with their investments, and at distressed times, you know, just go and redeem their investments. Please do not make that mistake. We have seen that mistakes happening again and again and again and again, right? And the latest being, as I said, the COVID one as well, where people have just took out their investment, and you have seen the kind of rally which has happened from April till date. And now looking at the outlooks going forward as well, the outlook looks pretty good. So invest for a longer period of time and sit there. I mean, you know, you will find these kind of volatile periods. Though it's easy to say, one has to kind of control your emotions on those things.
Yeah, and then, you know, I just want to bring in here. So this guy, Howard Marks, who runs Oaktree, is one of the largest distressed asset managers globally, probably close to what I think $120-130 billion he manages. He says that people always fear in such circumstances that world will end, but world normally doesn't end, right? So, you know, we have seen time and again, world normally doesn't end. Ultimately, this is all about cash flows, right? I mean, you know, the company is going to be there. They might not make money in a year, probably, and things are going to be, unless and until there is an existential situation with a particular company. I mean, you know, ultimately things do get better, will get better. Probably 1 year, probably earnings may not be there. Market always looks for the future, a couple of years down the line. And if there is an earning potential of the company, it's got a leadership, I'm sure it's going to perform. And I'm sure those companies will remain valuable. And if you get, so one of the things actually, you know, the guy, when COVID happened and things were getting cheaper, he said, it's good for millennials because they're going to actually be able to buy some of the best stocks at very cheap prices now, which didn't last long. But yeah, things did get cheaper. And that was a great opportunity to buy the stock at some of the great stocks at such cheap prices.
So. Absolutely, Raj. And just to kind of add, when I spoke about the flexibility in approach of investments, why I say also basically the variables underlying the economy, the markets keep on constantly changing, right? While you talked about cash flows, of course, those are the determining factors of the fundamentals of a company. But what has happened also is basically one of the new variables in the recent times has to be like the central bankers and the governments who have been constantly pumping in money. So the perceived valuation premium, which earlier people used to think, you know, is now extended beyond means purely because your cost of capital has become virtually zero. Your equity risk premium comes down, your valuation kind of extends further for an elongated period of time, which people would not digest, but they are not seeing the underlying source of funds, which is kind of virtually at a zero interest rates, which is there to kind of get deployed into, you know, growth economies. So that's where I'm coming, that the variables always keep on changing, newer variables keep on coming. And if you have a flexible approach of your investing, you will always be open to those kind of variables and can adjust very well to the changing needs of the investment world as well.
Coming back to, mental models and, you know, framework, do you have any specific mental model or a framework you use, when you manage your funds?
Sure. So, you know, as Raj, you were a macro trader, I'm more of a macro trader as well. But while you are being a macro trader, you've always kept on tracking companies for 15, 20 years, right? So more or less, you are aware of what the kind of company's business models are. Having said that, what you are extremely focused on is basically your incremental catalysts, which can be positive or negative over a period or over a medium term, maybe 6 to 12 months, right? Which actually help you to kind of start position, yourself on the investments, which can be earlier than your other competitors as well. So that's something which we always constantly use. Also, what we also try and analyze from a mental model perspective is basically not only, as I said, the investment, the business model, but also the outlining factors of ownership patterns, investment world consensus on the same, and try to analyze all these factors combined to try and, get our investments both on the long and the short side. So, these are just only few variables which we kind of track very actively.
One thing, actually, I was just checking your Twitter handle and I see that you follow quite a few chess players. Any specific reason?
I'm a huge fan of chess, right? From Vishy Anand to Magnus, who's the current world champion. You know, I get thrilled by that game. The kind of perseverance, the grit, the patience, the mental calculation ability which is needed, is just phenomenal. And I'm in awe of that game, to be very honest. So I just love it.
And do you play that?
Yeah, I do play, but not as a professional player, but I just enjoy the game, and I do definitely play continuously on online platforms.
Okay. And did you follow this new Netflix serial, Queen's Gambit, which is
Of course. Every chess player would definitely go and, you know, watch it for the first time. So that is something which kind of I saw it, and that's great reflection of what a chess player kind of goes through during a game. So
Do you think the chess and investing has got some similarity in terms of the way you look at both?
To a great extent, because you know what happens is basically in chess you always try to preempt moves, you try to calculate a lot of variables. So in a piece, in a chess board, there are kind of pieces, there are 64 squares, you kind of keep on maneuvering, and that's a finite universe of variables. Though a finite universe can have trillions and trillions of possibilities in terms of your games, but here in case of market, right, the number of variables, you know, always keep on changing. You have to adapt to your new strategies, new styles. You have to move your chess pieces, your investments accordingly, keep analyzing, keep calculating, and you have to be pretty active and on top of what's happening. So there are a lot of similarities between chess and our investment world as well.
Yeah, the only dissimilarity I would say is that in real world investing, actually both the players can win. You don't need there's no checkmate here. Yeah, both can win together. Yeah, that's one of the mistakes people do is that, you know, people is called, I think Michael Mobushin talked about this, that there's a first mistake of investing is that is a question around the base rate. People don't look, you can learn so much from others, frankly. I mean, you know, when you see others, when you read about others, you can learn so much. This guy, Monish Pabrai, actually, he built up a whole $1 billion fund just based on dissecting what Warren Buffett has done. Yeah, there's so much of learning which can give you so much of, you know, jump start to think about investing. So, you know, I would sincerely, that's the whole, you know, idea of doing this podcast as well, that we can learn from other people who have been very successful in their game. Some of the, rapid fire questions are probably coming to, our last 5 minutes of the session. So I'll have some few rapid fire questions for you. What was the first stock you bought?
I actually applied for an IPO when I was in standard 7th in school.
Wow.
So it was an IPO which I remember I applied for, though I didn't get the stock, purely because at that point in time, what used to happen is basically you have to apply and wait at home for the postman to actually come and deliver your share certificate or your check refund. Right. So unfortunately, the postman came and delivered me the refund of the check for which I applied for. Uh-huh. So those are the days. And that is how the interest actually began in investing.
Actually, one more question I want to ask is any stock you hold for a very long period of time?
Yeah, of course. I mean, of course. So for my personal investments, right, when I do, my risk appetite is pretty okay. I look for compounders of about 13 to 15% on a year-to-year basis. So I choose those quality of stocks which I can hold for a very long period of time, which can deliver consistently 13 to 15%, including your dividends. And I'm very satisfied with that. Luckily, that has worked well, you know, and I keep making the kind of consistent returns. I've held stocks which are more than 5 years, 7 years. Yeah, I've done that.
Okay. What was the last book you read and you found that interesting?
The last book, in fact, the book which I read and found extremely interesting is, it's one of my favorite books, is Black Swan by Nicholas Taleb. Yeah. And I would strongly recommend everybody to not only read, but try and absorb that book. Because when I mean reading versus absorbing is basically here, don't read as a storybook, just read 2-3 pages, absorb that, spend some time, and then move on, ahead. But that would give you a great color of how things are so random, the variables are so many, and you have to look for risk factors everywhere.
No, yeah, he writes very well. And actually, he's got a Black Swan fund as well, which he helps in managing. So a lot of people are not a lot. I mean, in some of the, I don't know how big the fund is, probably about a couple of $1 billion. And some of the people actually So it came into limelight again the last COVID, because that was again one of the black swan event, right? Who's your investing idol?
I don't have any. As you rightly mentioned, I kind of pick things up from various people, but at the end of it, I marry you know, investor behavior with a lot many other things as well. So it's a combination which I would always use, learning from many, many people. It is not one single idol which I have.
But anybody who you admire a lot?
Maybe George Soros to an extent. Yeah. But again, I would not completely say that, you know, it's just style that kind of fascinates.
Okay. Moving beyond investing, any life idol or anybody you admire as a person?
No, I'm in awe of the kind of wealth creation which has been done by Dhirubhai Ambani. He's a perfect example. He's a great example of rags to riches, right? And the kind of perseverance, the kind of consistency, diligence at it every given point in time is someone which I really admire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, the... He had a lot of grit and perseverance to do what he has really done, you know, at that point in time. I mean, you know, though probably Reliance would have created a lot more wealth, you know, by Mukesh, but what he did was really, really amazing. You've done some, you know, you've been very successful in your career. Where do you see yourself in the next 5-10 years?
We want to create an organization which adds great value to any investor's portfolio. Something which they have not seen, something... which they can, you know, they can count on us to provide a risk-adjusted return product, and we want to be identified something like that. So we want to maybe, I would say, Bridgewaters of India. That is where, you know, I would probably want the fund to be.
No, I mean that's a great target to have. I mean, you know, it's been Bridgewaters is one of the largest, or probably the largest hedge fund globally, I would say. And really done incredibly well. I think in the last conversation, you mentioned that you guys are going to launch a couple of funds. And one of the interesting you were mentioning about was related to ESG. Do you want to talk about that? I mean, you know, how do you see? Because that's something, you know, I'm very passionate about. And I mean, you know, there are great studies which shows that, you know, any company who takes care of the ESG. ESG stands for the environmental, social, and the governance, always gives more better shareholder returns. So, do you want to touch upon that?
Sure, of course, Raj. See, I mean, we strongly believe in ESG, and we do think that the time has come for ESG investing. The whole thesis and the premise is basically that if you take all your stakeholders together, whether it is environment, whether it is social meaning, your clients, your employees, your colleagues, team members, you know, and everyone together, along with your minority shareholders, which comes in the governance piece, you know, to a great extent, you avoid the tail risks of a business. Again, it comes back to the risk management of a particular business, where we do think that ESG is a great risk mitigative tool for avoiding the big tail risks in a business. If you concentrate on governance piece, you would have avoided pitfalls like you know, Satyam or any of those kind of weaker corporate governance companies. If you look for sustained employee benefits, you know, by having incentivized people, treating them fairly, it's a happy organization, and a happy organization would always create huge amount of value. If you take care of your clients, you innovate on products. And at the same time, environment. If you kind of protect your environment, you know, the sustainability of your business for a longer period of time pretty much goes up. So all in all, if you do track all these variables, especially on the ESG side, it makes your business sustainable and provides huge amount of better returns. So ESG, I mean, studies have shown that ESG companies have delivered far better returns than any of those kind of index returns which we have seen. And in fact, for our last 1.5 years, our fund also kind of demonstrates that if we apply ESG philosophy, the outperformance from the index is just there. I mean, you know, it's just a natural extension of better performance on your investments. So we are very compassionate. We are passionate about ESG as a philosophy in India.
So one thing, I mean, you know, which we all have seen, and it's a global phenomenon, is the rise of retail investors, right? I mean, been very active, the Robin Hooders or even in Zerodha and all those accounts, people have seen massive rise. Do you think that's going to, is that a new trend and that's going to sustain, or you think that was just more because of situational?
No, I think let's wait before passing on any judgment, purely because to a great extent that has been aided by work from home as well. And over the last 9, 12 months, whatever we have seen, one that millennials want to probably also want to get that color and the taste of the market. But at the same time, there are many businesses during these last nine odd months where there are many businesses which have not been operational. So people at home have kind of tried and extended, you know, at least, you know, watching investments channels and kind of trying to take a bet on the market and kind of done all those kind of things in the last 9 months. We wait and see how it goes forward as well. But my sense is basically the younger millennials may want to extend their investment thing, but there would maybe people also who would also go away back to, investing into funds.
Okay. So before closing the call, there's one question I want to ask, and, you know, is I'm a big believer of, you know, mentorship, and we've all had mentors in our career, and, you know, we have also mentored people. Do you want to talk about any great advice you've received as a mentee and any advice you've given as a mentor to people?
No, as a mentee, I mean, you know, we always, you know, our culture in DSP was like, we always used to just speak to our seniors, and whoever we want to, right? It was a pretty open culture, right? So I would always respect, I would always look up to Hemendra Bhai always, Jayesh Bhai always, right? Who would, you know, you can go and kind of share your thoughts, absolutely. So I think they were great in terms of their advice to us in terms of taking risk in a measured way, right? So, those were the seeds which were inculcated there. I mean, again, in Merrill, when I talk about risk, it was Rohit or Sudeep, which were there. I think they're the ones who actually brought forward that idea of looking at risk first, right? So that is something which I would always keep on telling investors, keep on telling everyone before their investments, that be comfortable with what risk you want to take. And I think you would be very, very successful once you are comfortable with, and you're married or you are harmonious with what you're doing. So, and you are at peace with it. So I think that is something which one has to be very careful about. And that is the advice that I would also pass on. Please don't look at risk first.
Okay. Thank you, Vaibhav. I think it was a great conversation to have, and, you know, we've known each other for so long. Good to see you doing so well, and trying to this is the platform through which, you know, we can try and give back to people in a limited way which we can. So I hope our listeners would have enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much, Vaibhav.
Thank you very much, Raj. It was a pleasure talking to you as always.